Welcome to Gospel Tangents, the best source for Mormon history, science, and theology. I'm Rick Bennett. We're continuing our conversation with Dr. Michael Quinn, and we're going to talk about how much money the church pulls in per year. It's a pretty astronomical number, if you ask me. We'll also talk about where does that money come from? Is it tithing? Is it for-profit business? What is the breakdown on that? So Dr. Michael Quinn will talk more about that in just a moment. We'll also like to remind you to please get a copy of our transcript from Sandra Tanner on the Mark Hoffman forgeries. Those are out now, and I've just delivered those to people who are our monthly subscribers. So please subscribe for just $10 a month, and you can get a copy of all of our latest transcripts, including this one with Dr. Michael Quinn. It's going to be a very fun conversation. So I hope you check it out. Now back to our conversation. So with your book, I think, at least for me, kind of the big headline that I think most people have noticed is how much tithing does the church make? And what's your best estimate on that?
Well, the tithing has to be understood as a revelation that was dictated by Joseph Smith in a form of thus saith the Lord, what he said the Lord was saying to him in 1838. But from 1838 to 1900, for most of the 19th century, the definitions of tithing changed and the adherence to this commandment changed too. And initially, it was very, very onerous to for a convert to obey the law of tithing as it was defined in the late 1830s to early 1840s, because what it required was a convert to donate to the church 10% of everything he owned or she owned, and then 10% of your annual increase after that. And despite that, thousands of people joined the church. But then under Brigham Young, this was liberalized, although that's a bad word for many Mormons today. It describes what he did, and that is he made it less onerous that to live the law of tithing. And it was only 10% after the initial years of the settlement in Utah. When these poor people had already paid 10% of everything they owned, were expected to pay 10% upon arrival in the Salt Lake Valley of what they owned at that point, which usually wasn't much. And those onerous requirements were finally in the 1850s ended. And by the late 1850s, all that was required was to give 10% of your annual increase, which was the term of the revelation, or interest, which was also a term that was used, but most people from that time to the present would think of it as your annual salary or your annual profit, the annual money that you made as income. And so that was the requirement from the late 1850s onward, but few members of the church lived it. And it wasn't until 1900, when a president of the church was faced with more than $2 million debts that the church needed to pay and had tremendous servicing of the debt, which meant that the church had to pay interest on these debts and also had to borrow to even pay the interest. Lorenzo Snow in 1900 made a dramatic push, you could call it, or a dramatic appeal to the faith of the Latter-day Saints to begin to pay more regularly, on a regular basis, their tithing, so that it could be a source of income to the church that they could depend on, and to more completely fulfill the 10% requirement. And from 1900 onward, this became a more emphatic requirement. But even then, by the 1920s, the presiding bishop of the church announced in general conference that only 25% of the church membership paid a full tithe, and the rest paid either what was called a part tithe or no tithing at all. So as a membership of the church, at no time, I think it's fair to say, has the membership of the church totally adhered. even the devout member of the membership of the church, have they totally adhered to the requirement of paying 10% of their annual income?
Well, so it sounds like it was quite some initiation dues between 1830 and 1850 in order to even join the church.
Right, and yet thousands did, and then it was liberalized to 10% only on an annual basis, and eventually you had the annual interview with a bishop. And I don't know exactly when that came in, but I think it was in the 19th century, not the 20th, when that became a pattern, whether it was required by church headquarters or not.
Your tithing settlement you're talking about.
Yeah, that's now what it's called. But the idea that it was decided on the local level, whether you were a part tithe payer or a full tithe payer, was in place in the 19th century. And so that has continued to the present. The general authorities do not make that decision, even for themselves. The general authorities meet with their bishops and their local wards or congregations, and like every other rank and file member of the church, are asked, do you pay a full tithing? And they either can ask and answer yes or no, and then the follow-up question is, do you pay a part tithing? Yes or no, and then the follow-up question is, are you exempt? Yes or no, and people who are exempt are often depends on sometimes church policies, which have varied. Missionaries have been exempt from paying tithing. People who are on church welfare have been defined as being on tithing, or pardon me, being exempt from tithing. But those have typically been the only exemptions allowed. Somebody who is a church general authority, for example, who has no other source of income but what the church gives him, is still expected to pay 10% of that back to the church. Otherwise, and I've seen the PBO reports, he is defined as a part or no tithe payer.
Wow. And they take away his temple recommend?
Right. It could happen.
Oh, wow.
And it wouldn't be the first time that a general authority has been threatened with being dropped from office for one reason or another. But in the tithing reports that I had access to from the 1890s to 1928, typically a general authority who said he was a part tithe payer was only on that in that status for a year or two, and then he became a full tithe payer. Whether there was pressure applied, I don't know. But sometimes it did last more than 1 year.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Typically, the general authorities were recorded as full tithe payers.
Yeah, I would expect they
should. Anyway, the tithing has never been 100% in payment. And in fact, in the 1990s, a Deseret Book publication said no more than 50% in the 90s, which would be a dramatic improvement over the 1920s. But it's always been a part even of devout members of the church who have paid a full tithing.
I would be surprised that it was as high as 50%, because we keep hearing activity rates are about 50%, and I wouldn't expect everybody who came to be a full tithe payer.
Right, and this was only an estimate by a non-general authority, but it was one that the Deseret Book allowed to be published under its authority, and so its editors really allowed that to be stated. Whether it was accurate or not, I don't know. But the lowest level that I have reported by a member of the presiding bishop was 25%. And that could be the area that it's hovering around, maybe 25 to 40% pay full tithing. But it depends, because I've heard praise given for, during the Cold War, for example, I heard praise given by general authorities for the members of the church in East Germany, which was a communist, very repressive regime, that they paid 80% of its membership paid a full tithing of what little they had. Mm-hmm. And this, you know, was remarkable. And I saw no reports of the International Church, and so I'm only going by what was said over the pulpit by general authorities in praising the devotion of members of the church in East Germany during those years from the 1950s to the 1980s. But that was something that was frequently I heard praised over the pulpit, not only at General Conference, but sometimes by visiting general authorities who, in stakes I attended, would make a comment about that tremendous devotion. So it varies, and I'm sure it varies internationally, and people who are very poor give the widow's mite. And this would be true of the poor in many of developing countries who barely have enough money to feed themselves and their children. And yet many of them are not exempted from tithing despite that poverty. And they do their best, and in some succeed to pay 10% and still keep their kids from starving. So I don't think we should be flippant about the fact that many people don't pay tithing. Many people who don't pay a full tithing are just barely getting by. And sometimes it's a matter of, do I pay full tithing, or do I feed my children, or clothe them, or give them shoes? And that's not just a problem in America. There's poverty in north of Mexico as well. But in developing countries, it's a severe problem. And so I think that those who do pay full tithing in the United States should not feel self-righteous about it. Because in the Philippines, for example, government statistics indicate that the average Filipino family can only provide one meal a day for every member of the family. And so those who do pay or struggle to pay a full tithing are really paying similar to the widow's mite, which Jesus praised.
Right. So what about church businesses? How, if I remember right, in the book you said you believe that the church makes about $33 billion per year. Do you have any idea how much church businesses bring in?
Well, I had the exact figures of church tithing paid annually in the period down to 1928, then again in the period of the 1940s, then in the 1950s up to 1962. And I could give you down to the penny how much church headquarters received in tithing from members of the church. After that point, I don't have those kinds of figures. And so I made a projection in the book of based on the growth rate of tithing, and it was growing at an annual rate during the 1950s. And I felt that that was a conservative way of projecting, because in the 1950s, the church was sending missionaries to war-torn Europe, which was still rebuilding from World War II, to war-torn Asia, which was still rebuilding from its devastation in Japan and the Philippines and elsewhere from World War II, and then sending missionaries and building churches, not only in those countries, but also in Latin America, where in the 1950s, 1% of the population owned 90% or more of the country's wealth. And that was true in every Latin American country. And so during that time period, the growth of the church still in that decade of the 1950s averaged 12.9% annual increase of tithing. So I felt that that applied in the future would be a conservative measure of the future growth of the church's tithing. So I applied that on an annual basis from 1960 to 2010. And I had an ability to check the first years to see how accurate my projection was, because I had the tithing figures for 1961 and 1962. And what I found was that my projections in that table were significantly below the actual tithing that the church received in 1961 and 1962. And so I felt confident that I had chosen a measure that was conservative. Using that straight line projection, the amount that comes up for tithing alone in 2010 is $33 billion with a B dollars. Now, on top of that is what I call commercial income from for-profit businesses, which are in or by their definition, are for profit. Profit from sales of generally nonprofit businesses like welfare farms to the general profit, or rather to the general public, which in those cases are made like Desert Industries sells to the public. And even though they sell at a very moderate rate, that is income, taxable income, by state and national standards. And then there is the portfolio of the church, which is stocks and bonds, and how much they make or don't make on that. And so I have several measures jumping decades of what that was. In 1900 and 1902, those sources of income, which I generally call commercial income, accounted for almost 18% of the church's total revenue those 2 years. And those were not years when the church's businesses were doing wonderfully. Some were, many were not. Then again in 1928, about 29 to 30% of the church's total revenues came from businesses and from investments. Then in the 1960s and 1970s, N. Eldon Tanner, who was a member of the first presidency, who was given a responsibility for the financial life of the church, he told two different reporters for two different financial magazines that in the late 1960s as well as in the late 1970s, the church was receiving about 50% of its income from tithing, and the rest came from investments and for-profit businesses. And so I estimate that by that it's conservative or reasonable to assume that 40 to 45% was coming from those sources. And in the later interview he gave in the late 1970s to a Canadian financial and business outlet or magazine, he said that the investments of the church he limited to blue chip stocks and bonds, which meant the highest pay, the most secure, the least risk involved in those highest levels of investment. So you can take your pick. The estimates from church headquarters have been too low. They've been lower than any of those verified estimates. Typically, church headquarters in from the 1950s to the 1990s has said 5 to 10%. That doesn't match any of the figures that I have from 1900s to the 1920s to the 1960s to the 1970s. So whether you take the low ball amount that I know is accurate in 1900s of 17% extra beyond tithing, N. Eldon Tanner's estimate in the 1960s or 70s of 40 to 45%, we're talking billions of dollars on top of the church's $33 billion tithing that I estimate as commercial income. So I think you could say $10 to $15 billion a year as of 2010 were coming from the various kinds of commercial investments. Businesses that are for-profit by definition, nonprofit businesses that sell some of their products to the public and therefore are taxed on those sales, and then the very large portfolio of the church. And to see, indicate how large it is, the investment houses, which again is a generic term I use, are scattered, and they know about each of their portfolios that they handle for the church, but they don't know about the other investment houses and what they handle and how much profit or loss they have in a particular day or a particular month or a particular year. But the central investment house from the 1990s and to the present, as far as I know, has called Ensign Peak Advisors. And the president of Ensign Peak Advisors spoke with Deseret News in 2003, and he said that each day his company handled billions of dollars, and that's only one of the investment houses of the church. So I think that my estimate of tens of billions is probably close to the mark of commercial income from all the sources, not just the portfolio, but also for-profit businesses and nonprofits like welfare farms that also sell some of their produce to the public at our, and are taxed on that.
Okay. So let me make sure I'm clear on that. So you're saying roughly $33 billion a year
plus
another 10 to 15, 10 or 15 billion of business income.
So it's I would say as of 2010, $40 to $50 billion in total revenues from all sources.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Dr. Michael Quinn. In our next conversation, I will ask him if he ever sees the idea that the church will ever have a paid ministry.
Even though the 19th century church frequently used the insulting phrase hireling priests for Catholic and Protestant ministers, the revelations in the Doctrine and Covenants, which maintain these thus saith the Lord documents that Joseph Smith provided during his lifetime, they provide for a paid ministry. They say the laborer is worthy of his hire, and that could justify having a thorough paid ministry all the way down to the local level.
I hope you enjoyed that short clip from our next interview. If you'd like to hear the entire interview uncut, please go to our patreon.com/gospeltangents and subscribe for just $5 a month. If you'd like a transcript of this, please click the yellow subscribe button at gospeltangents.com, and I'll send you this and all future transcripts. Also, if you'd like a paperback like we've got here, those are available at our website at amazon.com. Just do a search for Gospel Tangents. Please get all updates at our Facebook page at facebook.com/gospeltangents. We're also on Twitter at Gospel Tangents. You can also get transcripts individually at our website, gospeltangents.com/shop. Finally, make sure that you subscribe on our Apple Podcast page. Just do a quick search for Gospel Tangents there and give us a 5-star review while you're at it. Thanks again for listening. Your support helps create more Mormon history classes and podcasts such as this, and so I really appreciate you listening. Please share with your friends. Click here to subscribe, here for a transcript, and over here you'll see some more of our great videos. Thanks again.